Hey there, KingCast family. I've got a special treat for you today. Bresnikan and I, we're doing our own little spin-off show for HBO's It, Welcome to Derry. We're calling it Watching It because, well, that's exactly what we're doing. We watch each episode and then record a podcast discussing that episode in depth, point out Stephen King Easter eggs, dole out our praise, our critiques, everything in between as we see fit, etc. I mean, come on, it is a giant HBO Stephen King show exploring the origins of Pennywise. You know, we had to be in on the ground floor, starting with the very first episode, which you are going to be able to hear in full here in the KingCast feed. I want you to be aware, though, that this will be its own separate podcast, also on the Fangoria Podcast Network. So if you like what you hear, please subscribe to Watching It, Welcome to Derry, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want more than just audio, you can also find a video version of the show where it's supported or directly at the Fangoria YouTube page. You're all adults and you know how to search for things on the internet, so go forth if you want to actually see the beautiful middle-aged faces behind the voices. All right, KingCast fam, enjoy the exclusive feed drop for the debut episode of Watching It, Welcome to Derry, also available on the Fangoria Podcast Network and supported by our friends at Black Magic. And we'll see you back here in the main feed on November 5th with a very special episode of the KingCast featuring multiple guests, all of them first-timers, and all of them very, very exciting. Get in, losers. We're watching It, Welcome to Derry. My name is Eric Vespi, and I am joined by my KingCast co-host, Anthony Bresnikan. Say hello to the people.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Derry, or back to Derry, as it is.
But yeah, we are going back into the origins of Pennywise the Clown with this. Now, if you're listening to this and you're not a KingCast listener, we should probably introduce ourselves. Like I said, my name is Eric Vespi, and I am one half of the KingCast, one of the hosts of the KingCast, which is a Stephen King podcast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. And Anthony is my cohort over there. We are big Stephen King nerds, so we felt like it was pretty appropriate for us to weigh in on the big Stephen King TV show.
Yeah, we're pretty loyal, constant readers. I think we've been fans of his for most of our lives, and writing about him, interviewing him. You guys have been doing a show over there. I've been with you for the past year or so, and you know, this program came up. It is, and this is an offshoot of the KingCast. It is an interlude, as it were, which is an appropriate way of describing a Welcome to Derry podcast, because it's based on the interludes from Stephen King's 1986 novel, which were the little historical flashbacks that provided some context for the shape-shifting supernatural being that is feeding on fear, feeding on children in this town, and how far back it goes. It goes back at least as far as recorded history, and that's what King had with the interludes.
Which means it's prime material if you're wanting to expand into this world. Much better than a sequel, because if you saw the movies, not much to go with that Pennywise story unless you actually, you know, follow some of the hints and breadcrumbs that Stephen King has dropped over the years of does Pennywise live? You don't know. Some graffiti in the Tommyknockers says maybe Pennywise does live. You don't know. But maybe. I'm usually not a prequel fan. You know, when, not saying that there aren't good prequels out there. Godfather Part Two is one that is, you know, it's half prequel, half sequel, but it's, it really enriches all the characters. But for the most part, when you tell a prequel story, you are telling people or asking people to join in on a story that's, you already know the ending too, right? You're already well ahead of it. And, but you know, so I was maybe a little hesitant about this, but also was kind of excited because of the book, specifically because the book spends so much time diving into Pennywise and the way that he is over the decades and centuries, you know, kind of, infested Derry with this malignant evil, this kind of rot that's at the center of this idyllic small town, and so the text is there, and I think that there's some really incredible things that King writes about in the book that now mm-hmm. we're going to have the opportunity to see on the big screen or small screen, depending on how big your TV is.
You're saying the text is there in the sense that it's authentic Stephen King. This is not just one of those sequels or prequels where they make it up, like Pet Sematary Bloodlines, which was abysmal.
Right. The Rage Carry 2, right? There have been plenty. I mean, all the Children of the Corn sequels, the Mangler sequels. There's a lot of really mm-hmm. bad Stephen King offshoots. But there's a few things that gave me hope leading into this, and that was the fact that the Muschietti's are on board, and I thought they did a bang up job, specifically mm-hmm. with It Chapter One. You know, It Chapter Two is a little overlong and sloppy, but it's also, you know, it's got some really key moments in that I feel like they really understand Stephen King's world and his characters, and that is crucial, you know.
Yeah, and we should back it up a little just for the casual listener who just wants to dive into Welcome to Derry and isn't fully immersed in all of this. They come to us for this information. It's Andy Muschietti is the director, and his sister Barbara Muschietti, who was the producer of the first two It movies. Well, the most recent It movies, not the 1990 Tim Curry classic, but the most recent films, and they've returned to Derry for this series. So you get that kind of authenticity, too, if you love those two It films starring Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise. This is a return to that, and Skarsgård himself is coming back, although not in this first episode, right, Eric?
No, and that's they're going to be teasing out Pennywise. We know that much going into this, but let's dive into the opening here. I think this is extremely strong. I was grabbed instantly here, even though when I go into my murder mm-hmm. clown show, I didn't expect Robert Preston and the Music Man to welcome me into into the world, but it fits.
Got trouble right there in River City.
You got trouble right there in River City / Derry. Mm-hmm. You know, they're telling us, they're warning us right off the bat. There's a few things that I love about this. One, it's a very tone-setting sequence here where mm-hmm. you know, not only do you get this kid in the movie theater watching the Music Man, he snuck in, he's got a black eye, you know that he's had trouble at home, and he's sucking on a pacifier, so he's kind of reverting to young child.
Some arrested development there. He's not quite, he's very fearful and infantile in a way.
He's scared right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And you have a moment where he's chased out of the theater by the usher. He is seen by who will become one of the main characters in the story, the daughter of the projectionist. Mm-hmm. And she kind of covers for him. So you instantly get there's this community built up. And so you go, oh, is this one of our main characters? And then, unfortunately, within the first 5 minutes, you see he is not one of our main characters. He is a very central character, but he gets got, and he gets got right away. And
he's sort of the Georgie of this version of It, the little kid that goes down first and sort of sets in motion the other kids sets their antenna off, lets them know that something isn't right in River City. There's trouble.
Yeah, but this sequence is great, and the reason why I called it kind of a tone setter, this is telling you what you're in for the rest of this season. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe. Yeah, I haven't seen the full thing as we're recording this, so maybe they all, you know, hug puppies and play with butterflies for the rest of the season. But in this first one, it's telling you this, you know, kid who you're instantly sympathetic towards, you know, who you like, you know, he's actually doing the thing that you want people to do in horror movies. They don't know they're in a horror movie or a horror story, but mm-hmm. you do, and you're just like, get out. And what's he do? He's like, you know, screw it, I'm gonna hitchhike my way out of this city, don't care where, don't care how. And unfortunately, he is picked up by essentially the evil that is Pennywise that we don't
know. What are you talking about? They seem like a really nice family, Eric. I don't know. Maybe we're not all lucky to come from the Cleaver family, the literal Cleaver family. It's a mom and a dad, nuclear family, right? It's sort of a tween daughter mm-hmm. and a little boy. Mm-hmm. They look like they've got a car, the little station wagon that's loaded up. They're going somewhere. And they just look like the everyday family that you would see, on the box, back of a box of cereal or something. You know, the dad with the horn-rimmed glasses. The mom looks like, Barbara Billingsley. And they pick this kid up and they're like, okay, where do you want to go, son? And he says, anywhere but Derry. And I don't think that kid is ever leaving Derry now. So
he thinks so. And that's part of the cruelty of, you know, right away you see the cruelty of something like Pennywise, you know, who is the entity behind all this stuff. Mm-hmm. We don't get to see the clown in this sequence, but we get to see some really messed up things. There's lots of echoes of the tricks that Pennywise would later pull in the movies
I was going to say, I just want to tease it out a little, because like, what was the first sign for you that things were not right?
I didn't trust it to begin with, you know, just because they were too good. But, but you know, the obviously, I think it's when the daughter picks up the liver. Mm-hmm. She's so, like, it's like this really kind fan. Like, she's the mom's like, you know, she's pregnant. And she's like, here, have this blanket. You're so cold, you poor dear. You know, yes, you can come with us. Honestly, the first red flag for me was like,
too nice.
You know, hey, we're going to pick up this child. And they go, we should take you back home. He's like, I need to get away from here. And they go, sure, kid, you can come with us to Portland. And it's just like, well, if they're that happy to just pick up a kid off the side of the road and take them to another town away from their parents, things ain't going to go well. But it's a sign that, like, a child wouldn't pick up, maybe, because that's everything he wants in this situation. But it's a sign that instantly an adult goes, no real adult would be like, yes, child, let me take you in my car away from this. Yeah.
On the radio, they're listening to a news broadcast too. And I thought this gave a really good window into how it operates, right? It's not Pennywise. This is a different manifestation. I don't think a clown would have scared this kid as badly as the notion of a very broken family, like a not broken in the sense of divorce or something like that, but just twisted covering for a sort of malignancy. And you hear on the radio, like a broadcaster, I think he's talking about nuclear tests and the effect that the radiation is going to have on birth defects. And like all of this, I think, is sort of in the background as you're watching it. And then the mom, who's pregnant, starts to give birth in the car. And this is after the little girl, like, pulls out the liver, the raw liver. Like, she reaches into the little snack bag that every family on a road trip has. Mm-hmm. And instead of pulling out, like, Doritos or whatever the early 1960s equivalent is, she pulls out a little Tupperware container full of raw liver. That's fucked up shit. So right there, that's a bad sign. And then the mom starts giving birth, and they start saying weirdly sexual things about each other. And the mom is like telling the girl to keep her legs together. And the father says something about the mom being kind of slutty. It's like, what? It's like, okay, at that point, if your alarm isn't going off, I have serious pity for you, because you are a little too inured to weirdness. But that's when things really go off the rails. The baby pops out. It's a mutant baby with a bat wing and sort of looks like it's made out of baby doll heads.
That's the extra mutant babies get extra heads. That's how that works. So
yeah, but one of the heads is sort of blind eyed. But they look like Cupid dolls. The little heads. I guess that's what a baby's head looks like. Right. But I was reminded of that scene from Parks and Recreation later in the season when April and Andy are house hunting, and they go to this place that is obviously, like, it looks like the house on Niebolt Street. It's dilapidated, and Werner Herzog is the realtor, or I think the owner, who's just selling it. And they're like, what was this place? And he's like, do you remember the Pawnee Doll Head Factory? And they're like, oh, was this the Doll Head Factory? And he goes, no, this was the asylum where they sent people who went insane on the assembly line. And I'm like, okay, all right. This is what that baby looks like. It looks like something would make you go insane on the assembly line. And then it's screaming around the car and bouncing around and pinballing about. And then what happens to our little friend?
He reverts back into his childhood safety, and that's sucking on the pacifier, just, you know, checking out. He's zoning out. You know, obviously he tried to get out of the car, but there's nothing he can do, and he's kind of pressed up against the window. And we see the car, you know, before that even, the car, we see it's been driving consistently one way, but it's going back into Derry, and it's you're getting the the show, he's never going to leave Derry. I believe can't get out of Derry. Yeah.
I believe they're crossing the bridge that Adrian Mellon gets thrown off of later, right? Yep. Am I right about that?
When the fatal strike happens and the pacifier leaps out of the broken window, bloody pacifier into the river and then into the sewers where we get the title of the show. Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting choice by Andy Muschietti to, you know, he gives us the psychological torment that this kid endures, but he doesn't give us the physical violence. You just see this. You see Baby Yoda Pennywise go thrash forward at him. There's like a moment where it's just sort of looking, and it's looking. It looks a little cute at that moment. It's like, it's like turning around, like, what's going on here? And then it dashes forward, and you just see the window break and the pacifier fly out, but you don't see the violence actually hit the kid. And I think it's a very clever storytelling technique because he knows how far he can push it with the audience. And I think if you saw this kid actually die, it'd be a little too much right at the start. He saves the children dying for the end of the episode.
you can't give all the gold at the beginning. You know, you got to save some child murder for the end, you know.
But it also made me wonder, is this kid dead? What do you think? Discuss.
Well, you know, I know that the Muschietti's like playing around with that because that was one of the changes from the novel that they did for the It movie was that Stuttering Bill thinks that Georgie could potentially be alive still. Mm-hmm. And in the book, and in the previous adaptation, it was clear they found his body. He was dead. He was missing an arm. He was gone.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that he likes playing around. I get the feeling like this kid's gone. Like I don't think Pennywise is storing, you know, children up alive in this era. But who knows? Who knows?
Well, I don't think he's coming back. But I wonder if keeping them alive is sort of like a squirrel will gather nuts and store them in a tree for the winter. Because if you remember in the movies, when they go to its lair and they find the little carnival wagon, floating above it are these children's bodies, sort of in a little spiral. And
but they're all dead, though. The only one who isn't is Bev, and that's just because they got there right when he put her in the deadlights.
I guess I just wondered if they're like semi alive, or I've not gotten to the end of the season yet, so I'm speaking just theoretically. Right. Does Pennywise keep his food alive the way some predators do when they drag a gazelle back to the den?
Maybe. I think that there's definitely, especially with representing him spider-like, you know, there could definitely be the cocooning of the meals and saving it for later, packaging it away. Like you said, the squirrel analogy or the spider analogy, the squirrel one's much cuter, so let's go with that one. So that's not in the brain.
I can't believe King made it a big squirrel at the end of the book.
Well, that would really make the series like go off onto another level. They confront it at the end of season one and he's just a giant squirrel. And all the dogs in Derry just look up at once. Yeah. Ooh. So I think he's gone. I feel like he's gone. I feel like you're right that this is the Georgie moment here. I don't think that, especially with seeing the violence we're going to see a little bit later, I think what Pennywise tends to like to do, the entity behind Pennywise, what it likes to do more is just terrify the shit out of people. And it feels like this kid has been tormented before what we see, and not just from his family life. If he's trying to get out of Derry, I don't think it's just because, you know, his abusive father's, you know, beating him up or whatever. It might be. That would be, you know, more realistic. But I feel like he's been seeing things before, and he's at the tail end of that cycle. And we know that Pennywise or it likes to ratchet up the tension and the fear. And we see that, you know, later on in this episode as we meet some of the newer kids and they start seeing their own things. I'm not going to hold out hope that little Maddie Clemens is going to be popping up at the end of the season. I think he's gone.
I think he is too. Yeah, I think so too.
But we should talk about, we have that, you know, that great cold open. And like you said, it's kind of everything that we like about It and Pennywise and the It films. You know, it's showing that the attacks are psychological as well as physical. The mutated baby's really screwed up, and it's all pulled out of, like you said, the current events at the time. Mm-hmm. It's the nuclear scare in the early 60s when this is set. But then we should talk about the other storyline that's going on mm-hmm. outside of the kids, and that's the military one. So the other side of this is you see Leroy Hanlon flying into mm-hmm. the base, played by Jovan Adepo, mm-hmm. Who was in The Stand miniseries for other Stephen King fans.
That's right. He played the musician Larry Underwood.
He did.
He ain't no nice guy.
He ain't no nice guy, and but I can dig that man. So
baby, can you dig your man?
You like how I fit that in there? I told you we were nerds right up front. I told you we were Stephen King nerds. You've been warned. Mm-hmm. So there's this other side of this, and that is, you know, what's kind of going on in the adult world of Derry. You're going to have the mm-hmm. kids' world of Derry and the adult world of Derry that's shown here. And the adult world is focused on the military base, which again goes back to the King text a little bit, jumping off of mm-hmm. a very well-liked, beloved section that's never really been adapted, in which a kind of hangout joint, a gin joint, is set up by the people of color on the military base called the Black Spot. And in the book,
it's a juke joint. It's like Sinners.
Yeah, very much. Where it's just a place for them to hang out. There isn't a place for for these black soldiers to like kind of let loose in this very white bred town of Derry, mm-hmm. Maine. And, you know, it becomes a focal point in the book of like the hatred of the town showing up in Pennywise stoking those literal flames. And so people have been waiting for this. And I believe with everybody that's introduced here, especially one Mr. Dick Halloran, who it pops up driving. You don't really get to meet him. He's just in the background. If you're eagle-eyed mm-hmm. enough, you'll spot his name tag on, you know, on the
but you
lapel.
Don't get his name. He doesn't say his name until coming up to
until
the next
a little
episode.
Bit. Yeah, I think we
so
should
we're
be
getting ahead of things, but
we are. We're being a little transparent here, where we've seen the first few episodes of the season, but we'll be.
But the Muschietti's have also said that's who Chris Chalk is playing, and so
right.
you know,
and you can see it. I spotted. I was looking for it, you know, when I first watched it, because I really wasn't paying attention to a lot of the marketing and stuff leading up to this. So I noticed like he's standing in the background of one mm-hmm. scene, this character Chris Chalk, or played by Chris Chalk, and you can see Halloran is on his name tag. So if you're a Stephen King uber nerd, you already know this, but if you're not, that's totally fine. That's what we're here for, babies. It's mm-hmm. Dick Halloran was the cook in The Shining. He was the guy with the shine who mm-hmm. Helped kind of warn little Danny Torrance about what that hotel could do. This is, again, something pulled right from Stephen King's book. We know from the book that Dick Halloran was at the Black Spot, you know, when all the tragedy struck. So.
This is one of the early instances of King creating his sort of multiverse, right? Where he references other things. I mean, he did that a little bit. He was always quick to mention the rabid St. Bernard that killed the sheriff downstate in, I think it's in Pet Sematary, and Pet Sematary she almost stops in a town called Salem's Lot on the drive back from the airport to the town of Ludlow. But he really hadn't woven his universe together that much. You know, the sheriff in The Dead Zone is the sheriff in Cujo. But this was really an instance of throwing back more than a decade to The Shining. And in it, I remember vividly reading the name Dick Halloran, and I knew who that was. You know, I knew that was the cook who tells Danny, don't worry, the things you see in this hotel are just like pages in a book. And pages in that book showed us that King's universe was all interconnected. And so I think if Halloran were not a part of this series and this era of Pennywise in Derry, I think it would be a bummer for people, right? Imagine if Warner Brothers didn't have the rights to The Shining and it was held by, you know, Paramount or something, and they didn't want to let this character go.
That would suck. Then you have Richard Dollar Man, you know, there. Yeah, well, I mean, the fact that that, you know, they're very clearly setting up the black spot, you mm-hmm. know, sequence here. And this is something where, as you're listening to this, if you might have heard our episode with the Muschietti's on the KingCast, that'll have aired by this time. And we talk a little bit about that. When I visited the set back in my movie journalist days, I visited the set of It, and being the Stephen King nerd, I asked them about, you know, all this background material that's there, like the history of Pennywise and where he came from and all the things, because you get all these Bresnikan, you mentioned interludes, you get these interludes throughout the book mm-hmm. where we go back further and further back, as you know, during every cycle, kind of seeing what Pennywise represented. And this was the big one, and they told me at that point that the black spot was something they were considering to open the second movie with, should they be lucky enough to get one. This mm-hmm. is keeping in mind well before the huge success, the, you know, $1 billion success that it was kind of a modestly budgeted studio yeah. movie. I think it was a $40 million studio movie, and you know, they weren't greenlit a sequel until they started seeing those numbers roll in. And so they changed that to the Adrian Mellon killing for the second movie. But this
which
is
was the right call, because that's the story that really opens the book. You know, there's Georgie's right. killing in the 50s, and there's Adrian Mellon's murder in the 80s that kicks off the new cycle and alerts the losers that they've got to come back as adults. And you know, you mentioned The Godfather Part Two. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, like, King's structure on It is really fascinating. The movie has kind of teased them apart, you know. Even the Tim Curry version kind of had the kid story and then the grown-up story as a follow-up. And King really wove them together, just like Godfather 2. You get the past and the present, so to speak, at the same time. And both stories are moving forward in parallel and wrapping up in parallel. And he did that with the older version of the losers and the younger version. And so these interludes were really, it's a striking and complicated structure for a novel that I think could easily throw a reader, if not in such capable hands. Like, he really does keep you oriented as to where you are in time and space in the book. And this interlude, I think it's meaningful too, because Mike Hanlon was one of the losers. Mm-hmm. He was the black kid who, you know, experienced racism as a kid. All of the losers, you know, they experienced anti-Semitism and abuse because of the heavy kid, you know, Ben Hanscom. Every kid has their experience with bullying, whatever their identity is, whatever it is that somebody can zero in on as a potential vulnerability. You know, the losers all represent that. And Mike Hanlon stays behind. He's the historian of the losers. He's the only one who stays in Derry. And his first stop as he spends his adulthood researching the history of Pennywise is to talk to his father about being an airman, working on the base, going to this juke joint out in the woods, and experiencing the violence of Derry. And what he does is he zeroes in on these moments, these explosions of violence, and those are markers for Pennywise.
Right.
But what King's doing here in the book is really, I think, admirable. It's his version of Nick Lowe's "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding," right? He's saying, why is the world like it is? Why do societies go crazy and kill someone like Adrian Mellon? Like, why is there homophobia? Why is there misogyny? Why is there racism? And why is there cruelty? And all of the different forms that it takes in our society, Pennywise feeds off of all of them. And so this is, you know, the fact that this is a story of racism in the 1960s, I think is especially meaningful. This is before the Civil Rights era, and these airmen are serving their country, but it's a country that doesn't always have their backs. So, so it's fascinating. And we've seen Leroy before, Giovanna Depo's character. You know, he's the grandfather in the It movies. Right. And here he's the young dad, the healthy young airman who is brought in for a special mission that will be explored a little more detail in subsequent episodes. But I'm talking a little too long here, Eric.
No, this is, you're right on the money with all that stuff. And, mm-hmm. and you know, that probably can lead us into the time frame here, which I mm-hmm. want to talk about. And I don't know if it's you, you know, or if this happened to you, but like for me, I was instantly hit with like a pang of nostalgia when you're in that Capitol Theater, you're seeing the Technicolor musical up on the screen. You know, as a fan of the book and as somebody, you know, who watched the miniseries a lot as a kid, it's like, you know, it is really interesting and refreshing to me to see an It story in this era. Right. There's something about that idyllic small town that, as much as I think it was a smart decision to set the new movies in the 80s, you know, and having the current time be the modern day, as it were, you know, with the next cycle, you know, there's just something that a small town 80s and a small town 60s have completely different feels. And, you know, having that, you know, soda jerk, you know, working at the pharmacy, you know, kind of feel. The Norman Rockwell side of the It story was something I didn't realize how much I missed until I saw it here. And they play a lot with it with the intro, by the way, which you'll see starting the next episode. I don't believe they have that really incredible introductory sequence at the beginning of episode one. So
unless they add it, and maybe we saw an early version of it, the intro, it looks like postcards, right? It's the, you know what they say, like a picture postcard of a idyllic small town. So it's the postcard version of Derry. And we do get the Norman Rockwell side of it, you know, but we get the other side too, which I think Andy Muschietti and Barbara did really. They did really well, and King has it in his book, but they've expanded a bit. So you got the father's story, right? And here the grandfather, Leroy Hanlon. But now you get Taylor Page playing the grandmother of Mike Hanlon, Charlotte, and she's a, you know, a young black woman in a town that's mostly white, but they're nice to her, to her face, right?
Yeah.
She goes into the pharmacy and, you know, the pharmacist treats her with respect. His name is Kirsch, Mr. Kirsch. That's a name that, if you know the books, comes up later, is pretty significant. We'll find out a little more about who he is and why he's here. And there are connections to him back in the original movie, in his family, at least. Yeah. And I thought it was interesting that he's nice to her face. I wonder if that's... It's not what you expect in Derry, right?
Right.
And I think what's interesting about Derry is it is Norman Rockwell on the surface. It's nice to this young stranger who's here. Doesn't matter what color skin she has, except maybe it does when nobody's looking, you know? Right.
Well,
they're nice to her when she's at the counter, but I wonder how we're going to see things shake out going forward.
Yeah, no, that's I think you're giving a little insight into episode two there. I think that's when the family gets there. But that's all previewed here in the first one whenever Leroy gets into town and lands at the base, and suddenly like he is shown respect by his superiors, and you go, oh, is it just like a military thing where you know, he's obviously done some heroic act in Korea, in the Korean War, the Korean conflict, that we don't really know just exactly what it is yet, but he's done something to earn their respect. Is that it? Or is it because they need him for something? And but the very first time you meet the general, General Shaw, played by James Remar, you know, who you know from Dexter or The Warriors, or supposed to be in the original Hicks and Aliens as well. But that's a whole other podcast. We could talk about why he got bounced out of that one. But he's a great character actor. But he's at that age now where he's like could be that crusty, hateful old white general, right? And instead he shows up and the first thing that he does is he helps protect the rank and respect of Leroy Hanlon, and sets somebody who's not showing him the respect that his rank entitles like putting them in their place. And
there's a white airman mechanic who will not salute him and will not stand at attention in his presence, and James Remar's character comes in and reads him the riot act, essentially.
and again, that's something that's completely unexpected. Again, we're talking, this is 1962, I believe. And, you know, I think there could be some argument that maybe it's unrealistic, but I also think that it shows as the story progresses that I don't know how much this character truly believes in equality for all and how much he just knows he needs somebody of Leroy Hanlon's stature and fortitude to handle a job that he really needs done. So
I think you're walking a delicate line there. They don't really get into why he's brought to this town in this episode, do
they? No,
they
don't.
That's coming up. Okay. There's an explanation. There's a reason he's here.
Yeah.
And we'll be learning a little more about that as it goes forward.
And so that kind of takes us back as all that stuff is going on. You're being introduced to Leroy Hanlon. You're introduced to the fact that he's going to be staying off base. He's bringing his family in. Mm-hmm. There's a secret area of the base that's for some sort of restricted thing. All this is set up. And then on the other side, you're following, who you think is going to be the new kids, the new losers club at the center of this.
The new kids on the block.
which, again, a nice tie into the Muschietti movie there. You get the new kids on the block tie-in. You meet Teddy, played by McCall Karam-Fidler. You meet Phil, played by Jack Malloy Legault. And you meet Lily, played by Clara Stack. They all feel like that they're the new club. I mean, Phil is very much a Richie kind of character. He's always joking around and saying inappropriate things. Teddy's appropriately enough, very much like Stan Uris. And I don't think this is explicitly stated in the episode, but if you look at the credits, you realize his family is Uris.
It's not Stan's brother, because they're the losers we know are from a different generation, but I think this would be his uncle,
right? Yes. So
there's an older brother, the one who comes in and is like, when the lamp face has its freak out,
right?
You know, they're warned of the father of the family tells him about the atrocities that the Nazis committed, and he mentions using human skin as kind of leather goods, and the boy imagines that fear gets into him, and so Pennywise capitalizes on it, makes the lamp come alive, and then the brother comes in and sees his little brother.
Yeah,
the big brother sees the little brother freaking out over a lamp, and he just sort of shakes his head. He has some little joke he says, and that I believe
he's
that
like, I can't believe we're related.
Yeah, I think that's Stan's brother or Stan's father.
I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. And so there are connections to what we've seen, and I do like that it's not explicit. That was something where it's like, oh, or there's just another Jewish family. I guess you could also make an argument that it's maybe closing the circle a little bit too much and going, there's only one Jewish family in all of the history of Derry, Maine, and that is the Urises. But part of the whole thing with the movies is all about this generational trauma and this familial generational trauma. So to me, I feel it's very appropriate. So much of this is set up as them trying to explore what happened to Maddie, where, they start hearing Maddie's voice in the drain, he's singing the song from the Music Man. It's creepy. It's, another great touch. And you're going, okay, so here's this new group. We're getting the alpha losers. We're getting the original losers club. They're all filling the same roles. And then we get to the end of the episode. And you realize,
Should we get to the end just yet, or can we hang?
I want to prolong
it one more beat, because you mentioned the Music Man again.
Yes.
And I was thinking how appropriate it is that the Music Man is the intro and the framework for this first episode of Welcome to Derry, because the Music Man is about this cute little small town in the Midwest, and who comes in and disrupts things? A shapeshifter. Right? He comes in, he's a con artist who pretends to be this band leader. He's gonna con this town out of things. He's whispering. Remember the scene where he's in the gymnasium and he's whispering like, yeah, you should start a band, an oompa band. That's what we need. And he's whispering around. He's like Lyle Landley from the Simpsons episode where they get the monorail. He basically whips this town up into a frenzy, and that's what Pennywise does. It's the benign version of it, the Robert Preston, Professor Henry Hill? That's Goodfellas.
That's a slightly different...
Harold Hill. Professor Harold Hill.
Harold Hill, yes.
Henry Hill. The grandfather of Henry Hill the Gangster.
Yeah. Everything's a prequel and a sequel. Yeah.
The Goodfellas. Goodfellas is part of the it-iverse. And the Music Maniverse. Everything's a multiverse. But yeah, he I think it's symbolic, right? It's the shapeshifter who comes in and persuades the town to behave a certain way, and Pennywise does it in a very malignant way.
Yeah, and you know, also when he presents himself as an entertainer in his favorite form, form being the clown, and you're onto something. I think that that the Muschiettis and the writer of this episode, Jason Fuchs, was, you know, they were very smart in framing it like this. And I also do want to point out that they do make the standpipe a central place, which is great as a fan of the book and as a fan of, you know, going to Bangor and seeing the real life one, which looks exactly like the one in the story. It has a very similar thing. It's at the top of a hill where if you could actually go up to the top of it's been closed down for years, but if you could go up and like look at the balcony, you would see those gorgeous vistas and see the town, you know, going off into the distance and whatnot. I do like that that's kind of a central part. I also want to bring up some detail as well, and that is you can't have the entity behind Pennywise. You can't have it without the entity behind the light, which is the turtle. Something that's hinted about in the movies. You hear them when they're, you know, doing their little I almost call it skinny dipping. They're not quite that risque, thank God for you know being tweens. But when they're doing their dip into the lake, you know, they feel something, and it could be something scary. It's not, it's a turtle. He's like, oh, it's just a turtle. In the books, the turtle is representing the force that's bringing the good together to fight Pennywise. So just as Pennywise is this cosmic evil force, there's a cosmic light force, that is represented by a turtle. And, the turtle shows up here as a being of protection and a little being of mockery. You know, he is, you know, be like the turtle and, you know, duck and cover when the bombs fall kind of thing. And you get that, and then you get the turtle being the mascot of the school and, you know, being fun of by the bullies,
Doesn't the little boy who gets, who disappears at the beginning, doesn't he have like a little toy?
He does. He pulls out his like Cracker Jack prize, right? He pulls out, you know, he has a moment with Lily, played by Clara Stack. You know, like a bonding moment we see in a flashback where he takes her up to the standpipe. They look at the two figure, you know, they say, what did you pull out of this? And he pulled a turtle and she pulls a rocket ship. And he's like, oh, I only ever get the rocket ships. And he gives her his turtle and the turtle stays on her charm bracelet. So if you want to look at it, the turtle could have been part of his protection against the evil of Pennywise. And he gave it away to this girl who's going through incredible trauma. It's a gesture of compassion from this little boy in a moment where, you know, her father, we find out, had died in a horrible accident at a pickling factory, which sounds like the setup for a joke, but it really isn't.
It's like a horrible industrial accident.
Yeah.
That kills him.
That kills him and mutilates him. And
they put pickles in her locker to fall out and shatter on the floor,
right?
You know.
And we find out she spent some time in Juniper Hill, another Stephen King connection, the nut house, the famous nut house, which I think Juniper Hill is in the Green Mile, right? Wasn't that the fancy mental institution that they're trying to get Percy to go apply for?
Is it? I don't remember.
I think
that,
it might be.
It does turn up a lot. That's where Henry, as you said, Henry Bowers goes there in the later stories. Do they mention the name Bowers in this episode, or is that a later one?
It's a later one. I think we meet Daddy and Grandpa Bowers.
Like Eric said, these families are part of the fabric of Derry. But yeah, you know, I remember reading the books and not really getting the turtle thing. Or the books, the book.
It can be multiple books. You could break that book into four parts and it'd still be longer than most books you read.
The turtle is literally a totem, like on a totem pole, the way you have these sort of animal entities that American Indians sort of had representing various aspects of the natural world and powers that they imbued them with or had them represent at the very least, sources of inspiration and light and warning. And the turtle, so it's not actually like that there's a mystical turtle like Leonardo Donatello who's going to pop out of the sewers and fight Pennywise.
I don't know what creative impulses the Muschietis are following. We've never seen that.
Turtleverse. But it's like this macroverse where the turtle symbolizes, I don't know if it's like, I always took it as God, right? He didn't want to say God, but there's this, you know, the Native American myth of the planet of the world was that it's the back of a turtle. I forget which tribe actually had that as its, as its, origin myth, but this notion that a turtle is the earth, right? So it's sort of like the natural order and Pennywise is this virus or this cancer unnatural or entity or cancer that's, an invasive species and the earth itself, the spirit of Mother Earth, Gaia, is represented as this turtle. And so when you see it as the school mascot or it's in the video, duck and cover, that's how you protect yourself, or it's the Cracker Jack thing. Mm-hmm. It's almost just a symbolic totem of that, of that, of that benevolent force. So that's what that means. And the macroverse itself is a sort of place out of time and out of space, right? Pennywise is sort of a fourth dimensional being. It doesn't live in a linear way.
Right. And it's so, bound by certain rules in our dimension, but you're exactly right. And that's what makes it complicated. It makes it, there's a reason why a lot of that isn't, you know, dived into and too much in the movie adaptations. But, you know, I think King, when he was writing, really wanted to have, you know, kind of an explanation, if only for himself, of like, what is the force that's drawing these children together and giving them their power against this thing? And, you know, it's the force of, you know, love and kindness versus Pennywise, which is a creature of hate and fear. And so having that represented by a turtle, you know, going, using that myth, you know, I always found it to be really cool and something that obviously can't really translate without just getting into crystals and hokum and stuff like that, you know, in a visual medium. But I do love that, you know, the Muschietis went out of their way to include that. You know, there's a turtle Lego that Georgie had built that Bill is playing with in a certain point. You know, I do love that they represent the turtle as being there in the background, whether it's pulling the strings, whether it's, you know, just trying to protect it, things from afar. I don't know. Like, I don't think that they'll go that deep into it. Maybe they will. I don't know. But I do like that they're at least represented there, and especially the way that it's shown, you know, the turtle charm being passed on from one kid who isn't making it out of this episode and another kid who is.
Yeah.
Could be very symbolic of the power of that being. So I think that that then takes us to our ending. There is one other thing that I do want to point out before we get there, though, and that is there is a great headline where I think it's Leroy Hanlon's reading the newspaper, and it sees the controversy of this new Paul Bunyan statue that's being built.
Oh, yeah.
Which is very much one that the Paul Bunyan statue is real. It lives in Bangor, Maine. I've seen it. It showed the exact same design as what shows up in the later movies. But that headline is real. That's exactly how Bangor citizens reacted too. They were up in arms against it. They thought it looked gaudy and shitty. And
it does. It's a fiber. It's not even a statue. It's like a fiberglass figure.
I love it. It's like, so cheesy though.
It is cheesy. Like, I can see why they're like, this is a blight on the town. Like, it's not. And first of all, Paul Bunyan, like, who cares about Paul Bunyan? Like, what does he mean to people? Like, he's not some hero or you know,
it's a folk tale. And doesn't Bangor kind of like, it's Derry is the birthplace of Paul Bunyan is what's on the sign, but I think that in Bangor, isn't it like
logging?
The ox? I think it's the ox that they say is like where the ox came from. Paul Bunyan's
the ox. That's where Babe the Blue Ox came from.
I think so. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm talking out of my ass here. It wouldn't be the first time, but
I just think that Paul Bunyan thing, like, I've seen that. There's like a like an auto repair shop in LA that has like a giant Paul Bunyan similar type of like fiberglass thing, and it's from Fargo, right? Like, remember that's where that Babe the Blue Ox comes from, like William H. Macy talking about this this figure. I think it's a lot. There's a lot of logging that happens in Maine, and so maybe that was the connection.
The lumberjack part, I wanted to point that out, but let's get to the movie theater. So they all these kids, they get together, they are, you know, they're comparing notes, you know, you have the great lampshade moment, which one is, I want to say, is very horrific and extremely well done. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a well-executed thing. I think it was telegraphed pretty clearly once you're getting this big speech about the horrors of the war and people's skin made into lampshades and stuff. Mm-hmm. Right before he's in bed and he keeps flickering the light on and off, I'm like, oh, we're going to see some lampshade horror, and by God, we get some. But I think it's very, very effective, that scene. And so you have the, okay, I've seen things, this is real, mm-hmm. Moment. And so these boys agree to go help. And you get into this research sequence like you get in the movies. They're in the library, the little sisters tagging along. You're like, great, this is our new core group. You have all the angles represented here. And then they kind of track it down to the Music Man. They mm-hmm. figure out that the song that they're hearing is from the Music Man. They go and they talk to the projectionist's daughter, and
the song that's coming out of the drains is the Music Man.
Is You Got Trouble. And and so they track it down to that, and they're like, well, you know, let me confirm this. So she goes and takes them to the theater after hours, strings up the Music Man. And they watch that sequence. They're like, yep, that's a song. Oh, and by the way, little Maddie is now in the movie.
This, I thought, was a really effective scare technique, because you're watching that. Yeah. And not only is Maddie, the little boy who disappeared in this scene where the town is watching Professor Harold Hill sing You Got Trouble right here in River City, you know, but so is the creepy family that picks him up from as a hitchhiker, and they're in there as well. And I thought the cinematography on the that they obviously simulated for that, for the way the Music Man looks. What year was the Music Man? Was it like 1960, maybe?
It's got to be, yeah. But it's in that kind of the end of the Technicolor heyday, which is really hard to reproduce. Technicolor, if you're not aware, it was a coloring process that was where they actually use film dye in the film stock. They actually use dye on the stock to give it that vibrant color. That's why, like, the Wizard of Oz just jumps off the fucking screen. It's what, you know, you had this great, you know, kind of golden era of maybe, yes, cheesy movie musicals, but they always popped out when they were done in this Technicolor fashion. It was like kind of like the IMAX of its day. It was like, you don't need to watch your black and white TV. We come to see vibrant widescreen color, that, you know, in the theaters. Yeah. That was their
couldn't get that at home
answer,
you know,
right, to the technology. And
but it looks really good. The grain on it, it looked like the film. And so it takes a minute for you to catch on at what you're seeing.
And yeah, I'm with you. Like, I was so impressed by that. Just being a film nerd, I've seen so many people try to recapture that look, but it, like I say, it's a dead form. It is. It's, you literally cannot do that process anymore. It's impossible. All the factories are shut down. You can't do that. So you have to replicate it in some other way. And they do it in such a way where it fits so perfectly with the movie that you as the audience, at least I was, like, it took me, I did a double take. I'm like, well, wait, that's the kid from the thing, and from the opening of the movie. And then you get this guilt trip sequence where he's like, you know, you weren't there for me. They, you know, preying on all of their own, you know, insecurities and guilt that they feel, why, you know, this kid disappeared from the town and all that. And then that mutant baby comes back, is kind of pulls a Purple Rose of Cairo, jumps off the screen and into reality. And what you think is going to be, at least what I thought was going to be, the kind of big scare, the big set piece to end this, turned into almost a complete resetting of the board.
It's a bloodbath, man.
As three people of the four that were in the audience and five that were there total are murdered. You know, these children killed viciously. You know, you get a Georgie arm bitten off of the little girl. You get, you know, the smart-ass Richie character is, like, kind of thrown about and ripped apart in midair, and everybody splattered with him. It's one of those, again, it's kind of throwing the dick on the table, going, okay, you're you know, whatever your expectations for this is, we're gonna go against it. So
what's that a reference to? What movie throws a dick on a table?
Well, not a literal dick. It's like, you know, just that's how you, it's kind of a thing. It's like, bam.
Oh, I was like, a severed dick.
This is I don't know what the cultural background is of it. It's just a way to say that, like, you're confident.
Must be a regional dialect there. I've never heard that term before.
Yeah. Maybe we can rename the podcast. This new option is going to be called throwing our dicks on the table, and we're going to get a whole different audience than we expected to get. So
maybe he has this moment where the kids are getting snatched and, you know, by this flying raptor-like thing. Mm-hmm. And, I think your natural impulse is to be like Chris Elliott in Groundhog Day when he sees him go over the cliff and crash. And he's like, well, he might be okay. And then and then it explodes and he goes, oh, no, probably not now. So when you see the kid get snatched away, like, oh, he might be okay. And then when you see him, like, torn apart in midair, probably not now. And then the other little girl, like the little sister.
Yeah, Susie.
Who's
so
sweet. And then, like, she's reaching out for help. And then the girl who survives ends up just holding her severed hand. Like, oof. This episode really goes for it at the end. And I think it's very destabilizing because you're like, well, it pulls a Marion Crane on you from Psycho, where the characters you think are the main characters, they get dispatched. And I think it sets the tone that you don't know who's going to make it and who's not.
That's a much more PG way of saying saying what I said. It's more like Marion Crane, and I'm just like, there's dicks on tables.
Dicks on it. I'm just picturing, like, severed on the table. Like, who throws that out there?
Hey, you know, we got...
What kind of potluck is this?
The end of the season. We got hope for the end of the season. Maybe we'll get some dicks on tables.
Well, I feel like King has done that, right? Didn't Pennywise ripped something off of somebody at some point? I'm pretty sure. No,
there's lots of dick talk in the It book, but it's one that's very uncomfortable to talk about in public. So we'll avoid that. But
I'm thinking of the Dark Half because he kills like the photographer or something and like stuffs his dick and cuts his dick off.
Oh, and puts it in his mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, which that's I remember being like, that's like, all right, worse than death.
All right, Steve. Somebody's in a bad mood today when you were writing that.
Dark stuff, yeah. For sure.
But yeah, I really love that ending beat here because it's destabilizing, right? It threw me off my rocker. I thought I had, was predicting where this was going, and it's not there at all. And I think for good, like, it's a good thing that we're not just getting a carbon copy of the Losers Club where you have the smart ass and you have the more intellectual scared one. And then you have the strong girl and, and then you have the black friend or what, you know what I mean? It's like, I think it could have been very easy to just kind of look at this and try to retell a lot of the beats that were in the original movie that were pulled from this, same era from the King book. But, this is telling you at the end of this first episode, you're not getting what you're expecting. You didn't get the clown right away. You're not getting the Losers Club. And every time you're expecting something, we're going to try to turn it on its head, turn those expectations around. So
I sure do.
You know, I'm a big fan of this first episode. Like, I've watched it a couple of times now, and I love the feel of it. It feels right. I love the expansion of Derry. I love the expansion of the rot at the center of the town, the little seedlings that are starting, and I can't wait to dive into the rest of them with you, Anthony. Do you have any final thoughts on this first episode before we wrap up?
Well, that brings us to a nice close. I just will say, when I finished this first episode, I immediately thought, like, I was so shocked by the ending that I had to start the second episode, lucky enough to get like a couple of episodes in a batch as screeners. I just wanted to watch the first 5 minutes just to see, like, okay, are they going to pull like a Misery where, you remember how she complains in Misery? Like, you can't just undo it. Like, you can't have them in the Saturday morning serials, whenever the car goes off a cliff, then next week you go and you see that they jumped out of the car just before the cliff. Before it went off the cliff. And I was like, are they going to do a thing where it was all a dream or this isn't quite what you think? But no, it's what you see is what you get. And
it's a catalyst for a lot of really crazy stuff. We won't get too much into it, obviously, if you're listening to this right after the show airs. We don't want to spoil things. And also for, our own personal thing, I can tell you, I've seen the first few episodes. Anthony, you've seen the first few episodes. But I think that going forward, when we get to the new stuff, we're not going to be looking ahead. ahead. We want to be able to react to this in time and record this in time as you guys are. So, but I can't, I will say that, you know, that this does set the table for, you know, some of the horrors to come, and some of the punches aren't pulled that, that you might think that that would be. So, I'm excited about this. You know, I'm very eager to hear what the reaction to this is going to be from the horror community writ large. You know, I'm thankful that you're here with me, Anthony, going through it, and we'll see on the next one.
I'm glad we made it to the end of the first episode without being killed.
Well, I am wearing my turtle charm. Did you get the charm? Did you get the charm? No.
I gotta get one.
Well, we
gotta
better go
one.
Before Anthony gets murdered by a mutant.
Am I not turtle enough?
Mutant baby. You're not turtle material, I guess. So
not turtle enough for the turtle club. All right. We'll close things out with a Master of Disguise reference. We'll catch you guys next week.
Bye.